Right. Now this morning, our theme is Man in Present Living and Future Hope. For those who perhaps have maybe just forgotten that what we're about in this course is not so much what is practical counseling, although we'll be talking on that next week, as to getting an understanding of man, anthropological understanding of man, so that that can help us to understand those to whom we speak and seek to help and so on. And yesterday we have a pastor's prayer meeting here on Friday morning, seven of us, which is the perfect number, meet together, and all perfect pastors, so it's a great time. And we were talking, well, slightly imperfect, going cheaply. But I was saying that there's a passage that comes to my mind time and time again, and I mean to share it on Saturday mornings and always forget, so I'll share it first before we start the study. It's from Proverbs 30, and beginning at the first verse. The man says to Ithiel and Ucal, we don't know who they were, he says, "Surely I'm too stupid to be a man." It's interesting, isn't it? "I'm too stupid to be a man. I have not the understanding of a man." Of course, man here doesn't mean just a male. "Surely I'm too stupid to be a man. I have not the understanding of a man." So he's really implying that to be a human being is quite a thing. And he's veered off from that. "I have not learned wisdom, nor have I knowledge of the Holy One. Who has ascended to heaven and come down? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has wrapped up the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name? And what is his son's name? Surely you know." Bit of irony there. But he's really saying that a man is somebody who's learned wisdom and has knowledge of the Holy One. It's a great passage, really, to keep in mind. All right, now to our notes. Where is this person at now? We said it, if you're thinking in terms of counseling or in terms of any kind of ministry, we've gone through the various aspects of man as innocent and fallen, as being redeemed, as seeking out holiness of life, as a person looking to his destiny or her destiny, and we've got to recognize where people are at. We trust that what we've seen of theological anthropology, we'll be able to recognize where any person is at, especially those who come to us for friendship and help. If you really want to know where they're at, just let them talk. People will soon reveal where they're at, even if they don't realize they're doing that. So far we've dealt with the nature of created man, the nature of fallen man, and the nature of redeemed man. We're now about to deal with man in his present state, that is, man as he is now, but as a creature who lives between the past and the future. So we've got a new book today, just come off the press, The Wisdom of God and the Healing of Man. And in that, there are quite a number of themes, because it's a compilation of a number of counseling courses we've done, set out very well. And in that, there are a number of subjects that we want to come to. And one of them is on the matter of the past, of the three tenses in which man lives, the past, present, and the future. And that's very, very important that we grasp that. About to deal with man in his present state, that man is as he is now, but as a creature who lives between the past and the future. He will be fallen man or redeemed man when we meet him, but for certain reasons, whether redeemed or not, he may be puzzled by a number of factors which we now seek to understand. You can take it for granted that Christians don't have all knowledge, and they don't understand everything, and they're not all that well equipped. So we'll try here to deal with both the fallen man and the redeemed man in the present, as they live in the present, in the tension of being simultaneously creatures of their past and their present. And I think that's very understandable. If you have a bad past and you don't have a very good outlook for the future, if you can be so free of your past, or rather not free of it, but free with it, that's the great thing. Not free of it, but free with it. And in the book Miracle Over the River Kwai, Gordon, the man who wrote the book, says that the Japanese tried to destroy memories of the prisoners. Now, I don't think they actually set out to do that. I don't think it would have even thought about it. But what was happening was doing that. And once you've lost your memory, if you've ever been an amnesiac, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you've ever lost your memory, you're kind of rudderless, you know, purposeless. So it's better to have a bad past than to have none at all. Much better, of course, to have a good past. And what we say, a purified past. You think I'm doing some commercials this morning? Well, so I am. If we say we have no sin, it's a good little book to help people tidy up past, as with its companion one, The Cleansing of the Memories. Now, they're only small books, but they've got a lot of valuable material in them. So I would recommend those without any hesitation. All right, now, the fallen man in his present tension. And if you say the fallen man doesn't have tension at the moment, then you're going contrary to everything that's being said today. We're talking about stress in a way we never talked about it before. Stress has become really stress, and so on. So, fallen man with a memory of innocence. The matter that confronts us is, how can we recognize the point at which any person may be now be with whom we have to deal? In what state will such a person be? And we will need to know in order to be helpful. Of course, we will not meet one who is at that pure created state, but one who in man unfallen was in that state of innocence, so that everyone we meet will have some regard, some memory, and perhaps some nostalgia for the primal unfallen state. It's surprising how many books and films today have the word Eden in them, isn't it? And it's there, it haunts man, the idea of Eden, the idea of perfection, the idea of paradise. Some people who probably know they're never going to get to paradise have decided to build it here. So the primal ontology of it will be with all whom we meet. Now, ontology, as we've said, is the study of the metaphysics of being, but it is things as they were created, as they are, as they truly are. And so you'll find in everybody an ontology of the innocent state, of the unfallen state. It's there, something you can speak to. So this primal ontology is the truth which man in autonomy seeks to suppress. Man in autonomy, of course, is the one who is ruling himself, seeking out his own way of life and so on. Fallen man and the problem of existential and objective guilt. We've touched on this before, we'll just try to add a little bit more today. One of the elements of objective guilt is that man is uneasy about judgment. And this uneasiness impairs his enjoyment of life. And as Isaiah said, the wicked are like the rest of the sea, which casts up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my Lord, to the wicked. And if we could really understand that, because whenever we meet a person who's in a state of unease, we tend to look at the circumstances, the environment, and the present situation and say, that's why the unease is there, but it isn't really. The unease is man who is not in total fellowship with God, is deficient as a human being, and is in that state of unease. And Americans talk about having a monkey on your back. And some people carry a monkey on their back all their lives and think that's the norm. And then when suddenly they get converted or they released from their guilt, can't quite cope with it. Remember once a mission in New Guinea, and if any man was compulsively, guiltily active, it was that man, a brilliant man he was too. And then when he came into release from his guilt as a Christian missionary, he got so full of joy and so full of peace and love and wonder that he said, I couldn't handle it. He said, I said, Lord, turn it off, but turn it on again later. The release was so beautiful. Now, existential guilt, and we say again, man is an existent inner world in which God has placed him. The creation in which God has placed him is perfect because God created it. And a man is perfect because God created him. But because of man's rebellion, he is an existent that is not fulfilling his role as a true existent in his environment. So existential guilt exists because man does not live in the fullness of the imago Dei, of the image of God, which is very, very dynamic. That is, he does his own will and does not live in the serenity of doing the will of God. And though we remind ourselves in the Lord's Prayer, we say, "Thy will be done." I wonder how many times we really meant it. I mean, except in a loyal sense, say, you know, whatever your will is, let be done. But I wonder how many of us would say, whatever God's will is, that's what I want done. Now, that's where man's existential unease comes from, because he's not moving in the will of God. And don't ever underrate that, the power, the dynamics of that. So he does not live in the serenity. Remember, Jesus said in the volume of the book that is written of me, "I delight to do thy will." He said, "To do the will of my Father is my food and drink." And of moving towards the very wonderful destiny that God has for man. That's a good thing, to hone up on what the scriptures talk about as the destiny of man. See, one young man around Adelaide who gives out lots of tracts, and he keeps nagging at me to write a tract about vocation and heritage. He said, "Well, you know, people could see where they're going." Of course, they won't unless they have a new view of God altogether. But it's the great dynamic of lives, where we're going. The dynamics of vocation, and there's a whole essay on that in here, by the way, on vocation. The dynamics of vocation are involved, which are also the dynamics of hope. Having no hope and without God in the world is a painful way to live. And we wouldn't really understand it. Some of us have been Christians for years, have forgotten what it was like not to be one, forgotten how lonely it is. It seems then that fallen man will not be difficult to recognize, especially if he or she has not been transformed by God and his gospel. And that was our theme last week. The evidences of guilt will be about him or her if we listen patiently to what is said to us, and we should refer to study 2 to detect the state of that person. Study 4 and study 6 will be helpful in dealing with fallen man. But we must not think of fallen man as a stereotype. It's interesting how we do. You see, even in studies that we're doing over these weeks, we tend to be abstract, to talk about man in general. When you come to a human being in particular, you will never meet two persons the same. Years ago, before they had fingerprinting in France, they used to type a person by their weight and size, height and so on, dimensions. And some, of course, were more outstanding than others, but used to carry the whole matter in front of them. But apparently, no two persons have ever been identical in weight and size dimensions. No two persons ever been. It's just as easy to know. In regard to blood, Jeff, what is the no two persons? So it's just the same as fingerprinting or weight. No two DNAs as well. So we are really extraordinary, aren't we? Everyone is so unique. Isn't that incredible? Some say when God made the mould, when God made us, he threw away the mould. And so I point out sometimes more mouldy than others, some of us, but I'm a mould person myself. So the use of a theological grid is not called for, as perhaps, I can remember once going into a Christian bookshop and looking at a book on counselling, and I really could not believe what I read there. That was all figures, all set out in graphs and all kinds of things, and told you the way to counsel a person. You stood beside them and you put your left foot forward that way, and you put your arm around the guy this way, and you kept your hand free to open up the Bible and bash him with it in that hand, and so on. I couldn't believe that we're not stereotypes. Everybody is utterly different from anybody else. That's why I think when we do the phenomenology of human beings, that we miss that point. You know, all children at the age of 5 do so and so. The way they do it, which is different. as some of us know, who are parents, and particularly grandparents. So what is common to all human beings is existential guilt and objective guilt. But this fact is not always known to the person. I would guarantee that the person that you're trying to help with what's called a poor self-image doesn't realize that he or she's got that, not because of some deficiency, but because of a simple fact that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. So everybody's got that inbuilt into them. What we need to see is that every human being is accountable. Again, there's an essay on accountability, which I think we have a pastor's group here once a month, and pastors wander in, you know, the effect, and have a glance at the title, and this morning some of them said, oh, we're going home. It was on accountability. I can still remember that. Was it you who said it, John, was it? We're going home. Accountability is something which is always facing us. All human beings often refuse to be wholly accountable for their states of being in action, preferring to blame what they call conditioning factors, such as parental upbringing, heredity, environment, and circumstances. And again, those four things are dealt with in this series. This morning I didn't give you the number of the book. I made it in my little self-justifying, the colour of the book rather, and I made it my self-justifying operation sprang into action, and I said you ought to have known that. Social renegades and criminals generally blame society. That's the two and the thieves that were crucified with Christ. What we need to keep in mind is that man under guilt is never secure, never at peace, and is compulsive in seeking to be justified. It's very, very important we see that. Very important that we see that. I've been saying lately that how clever we are in getting people under guilt. That is the attack form of self-justification. Get a person under guilt. You know, like, you think of the one when people say to me, you don't take sugar. Oh, sugar's not good for you. I say, oh, it's only natural. It's interesting how the advertisers took that up, you see. It's natural to have sugar. All right, we won't go into that one. I can see people restless, ready to argue for their particular position. So this is the drive for almost everything a person seeks to do or attain. That is why accountability is rejected in much of life. Now, the accountability of human persons is set out in Ezekiel chapter 18. And we could just look that up if you have a Bible there. Just look up Ezekiel 18. Quite important. We can't do the whole subject, of course. Ezekiel 18. The word of the Lord came to me again. What do you mean by repeating this proverb concerning the land of Israel? The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. As I live, says the Lord God, this proverb shall no more be used by you in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine, the soul of the father as well as the soul of the son is mine. The soul that sins shall die. Now, the soul that sins shall die is not a general statement. It's not a proof text of the fact that everybody's going to die. What it's saying is only the soul that sins shall die. It shall die because it sins. And if it doesn't do these particular sins, then it won't die. So that you can't say, my father sinned, and so I'm in the state I am. See, and of course in Israel they had a perfect answer. They said, well, the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. But they forget what it says of them that hate me. And in this case it's idolatry. They're idolaters. So that if you follow in the part of idolatry, well, of course the sins of the fathers will be on you because you're in them. But for those who don't, and then the rest of the chapter tells you that you can be the son of an evil father and decide to go the way of good, and you'll save your soul alive. You're not fatalistically caught up to the fourth generation thing. By contrast, he'll show mercy to thousands of generations. Not to thousands that love him, but to thousands of generations. And that's a great subject all in its own. That's still pretty thoroughly in this little book here. We won't go into that this morning. Keep it all for the first of December when we're going to talk about all the things in all the studies. So we say, some Israelites have taken Exodus 20, 4-6 and 34-7 to mean that inevitably and mechanistically the sins of the parents will be visited upon the children to the third and fourth generation. In fact, the qualifying clause, "them that hate me," is linked with the children. That is, the nexus of judgmental visitation can be broken where the child or the parent turns to righteousness. Now, we are very jealous for the freedom of man, aren't we? The freedom of will. It's been argued and debated by men like Luther and Erasmus and Calvin. But in practice, we all have freedom of will. Whether we do have it essentially is another story which we won't go into today. That is, God does not cause the children to suffer if they refuse to go the way of their erring parents. Only the soul that sins shall die. And I hope you'll get these notes later on. I think they're all very useful. If there is not personal human responsibility for all actions, then human dignity is lost. Now that's very important to know that. And I find that a number of my friends who counsel always counsel on the principle of the victimization of their counselee. And I think that's a very dangerous doctrine, to treat people as though they're victims of those four things we talked about: parental upbringing, heredity, environment and circumstance. If you treat people as the victims of that, you'll never give them the opportunity to stand up and be really, truly human. You see that? They're responsible for all they've done, and from what I can gather from the scriptures, from inside the womb. You take the story of Esau and Jacob. So in Ezekiel 18, 25 to 32, God refutes the accusation that his way is not just. See, they say the way of the Lord is not just. And this transference of guilt by man from himself to God is an ancient custom and device, part of human self-justification. Would you agree? Dossiers on God. Some people are expert on all God's failures. They've got to be. It's a diversionary smokescreen, so they don't have to face up the issues themselves. So don't ever get caught up in arguments about God. What about all the children that are deformed and all the people that are suffering and all that? Don't lay that all at God's door. And don't even try not to. You can get absorbed in that justifying God. You can get absorbed in justifying God quite easily. And if you do, I suggest you probably are uneasy yourself, trying to convince yourself. All right, now, fallen man and human anger. Here he goes again. Angry heart and tranquil mind. I'd be interested to know how many people have a copy of this book. It's quite a large number. A copy of it? So anger and guilt are linked together. Let's have a look at our little note there. Oh, not that one. Note 11. In Colossians 1:21, the Authorized Version has, "And you who were sometimes alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works," that is, by being guilty, "you felt enmity to God." Turn to Job chapter 1. Fascinating little passage. The Puritans used to use this a lot. And it says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. Then it says, there were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. Verse 4, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them. He'd rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. But Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." It's interesting, isn't it, the principle that when you sin, you curse God. In your guiltiness, you have to put him down, otherwise the intensity of your guilt will be intolerable. So anger and guilt are linked together. Now, man who has broken the law of God is angry with God. Could you give me the first example of that in the scriptures? Cain. He offered his sacrifice in anger because God didn't receive it, but he offered his sacrifice in anger, which is one of the reasons God didn't receive it. That only increased his anger, and so the whole matter compounds. So fallen man is generally angry, and I don't. There's no sense of ego when we recommend books like this. But the number of people who said I thought I was not an angry person. I started to read that book. I got really angry and threw it away. And then I was intrigued, so I came back and picked it up again and read it. And I discovered I'm an angry person. Well, that shouldn't surprise anybody, because I would think that 100% of human beings are angry people. And if you just get a little bit of reaction to me saying that, there's the proof. I tell the story of this woman who rang up when this was being reviewed on a Sunday night talkback session on the radio, and she rang up and she said, I'm not an angry person, but when I hear Mr. Bingham talking about us being angry, she said, I really get angry. And she eventually got hold of it. We gave her a book and she read it, and she said a few Sunday nights later that it transformed her life. So that's it. So other anger, like other sins, is self-concealing. Now it's interesting, because the deceit of sin is that it tells you it's not sin. And how easy it is to rationalize about anything that you've done that's wrong. So man deceiving himself that he's not angry. Human anger most quickly reveals itself when one cannot get one's own way. I would think that's the simplest explanation of anger, when you can't get your own way. We have door handles on our house up there that are sort of pointed, you know what I mean? You're going past, they grab you sometimes, you know, through your jumper or your sweater or something, say, come back here. And I remember I got angry at the door. Could you imagine? I got angry at the door. In prison camp, we were sitting one day watching, and we had water taps there. That they, when you turn the tap on, the water just went like that. And this one fellow, and he had one of these old enamel plates, you know, they were still iron inside or steel or something. And this one had been battered, and it had a very good cutting edge on one section of it, you see. And the fellow held it there, and as the water went onto it, painfully caught him in the, and he got so mad he threw it down on the ground and he kicked at it with his bare feet, and if he'd connected with that part he might have lost a toe or something, and he missed it, and he said, lucky for you, your so-and-so. So I reckon we could all recognize ourselves there. And I always love this one they put in the films, you know, when somebody gets angry, kicks the car or kicks the door or something. Anyway, I've come to terms with our door handles. I wish they were all round door handles. But this mower is so temperamental, says the man. We wish to follow our own wills and not God. So that's the first thing. Now, we said before, man is uneasy because he's not following God's will, and we have it even. Keen Christians have it inbuilt, the idea that if you're doing God's will, it's really dreary. It's really dreary. God's all about religion, do you know what I mean? And all that sort of stuff. That's not true. Secondly, we have guilt for following our own wills. The two things are linked together. That's the same, going our will against God's will. And thus the guilt increases. And thirdly, things and persons which prevent us carrying out our wills are often blamed. But the guilt-attending states and acts of anger makes persons uneasy, thus liable to compounded anger. If you're in an angry state, everything upsets you, you know what I mean? And you've seen other people this way, I'm sure. And as your anger compounds, it gets worse and worse. Oh, I've watched it. If we look at the list of human sins in the scriptures, there are a few of them which do not have anger at the back or the front of them. Now take the one from Romans 1:29. They're filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. That's a pretty powerful description. And there's anger at the root of all of those.
And they loved every minute of it.
Yeah, they loved every minute of it, yes. Yes, there's something bittersweet about anger, isn't there? Mm. And now, Christ took it as a very important matter. You've heard he said that it was said to men of old, "You shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool shall be liable to the hell of fire." There's a whole list of verses that are taken and put into here, all put together, make a very formidable picture of what anger is. We also have a little book here called The Justice Men and the Great Rage. And that's been a great help to a lot of people, The Justice Men and the Great Rage. People really get angry today and think they've got a reason to be angry. It's wonderful to find a reason to be angry, isn't it? And all the sermons that you find on people's cars, we are gentle angry. Isn't that lovely, eh? Yeah, it's really good, yeah. Peace. And they fight the pigs. So it is true that this was spoken. Now, mind, there is a point for anger. Somebody said to me once, how long can you, what's it reasonable to keep your anger? And I said, I'd find about a minute. Because well, that's long enough. It's too long, really. I was at a men's camp once, and I said to them, how long is it permissible to keep your anger? They said, till sunset. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. Well, of course, by sunset, if you haven't done something long before sunset, you're probably caught up in it anyway. And I've heard that if you get angry and go to sleep, you might wake up and not sleep for a while or something. I've heard about that, and I'd like to pass that little bit of information on to you. Now, it is true that this was spoken by Jesus to people under covenant, but its principles are also creational. In any case, anger is possibly the most dangerous element in history. Nearly all homicides are within the family. It certainly brings enormous suffering to marital and familial relationships. Some of my pastor friends, when this book came out, they thought this is a great thing. So they started to preach about human anger, and boy, did they get a response from their congregations. Some of them came back and said, "Well, they're all aroused about anger." They said, "But what do you do about it? how can you get rid of it?" So don't, awake the sleeping lion if you don't know how to tranquilize it. Fallen man and the need for emotional fulfillment. A general reading of the Psalms will show us that covenant persons knew the love of God. Don't ever think that in the Old Testament God was fierce and angry and he's had a change of heart from Malachi to Matthew. The same God. The covenant itself demanded the person's love of God, love of neighbor, and commensurate love of self. Now, today we've been told, of course, that we must love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and strength, and our neighbours ourself. And some people say, well, if you don't love yourself, you won't love your brother. So love yourself first, and then you'll love your brother. It's not true. It's the other way around. We love because he first loved us. But then we love him, and we love our brethren, and we love ourselves. Right and proper that we should love ourselves. Unlike today's approach to love, the principle is not one of sentiment and romance. Love was never thought of as an emotional thing. Love was an indispensable necessity for people in the wilderness or living in Palestine amongst and against enemies. It wasn't just utilitarian, but if you loved your neighbour, you didn't shift his landmark. Do you know what I mean? You didn't pinch a bit of his soil. If you loved your neighbour, you'd pull his ox out of the bog and things like that. Very practical things. Doubtless love was a creational thing from the beginning. Because God is love. God created in love, and he structured man as a love creature. And you mustn't miss that. That is natural to love. It is unnatural not to love. Right? It says it takes more muscles to make a frown than to make a smile. I'm sure there's a message there somewhere. Anyway, someone says you're better off if you love. It's harder. You're worse off if you hate. The drive and search for fulfillment often causes immense pain and cruelty, particularly in the area of sexuality. You know what I mean there? It's drive for love, fulfillment. So we need to be emotionally fulfilled. There's no doubt about that. Emotional fulfillment can be found only in God, in relationship with Him, in being in His presence. And we have a little book here called The Everlasting Presence, and I think it's a very helpful book to think in terms of God's presence and to know that. The answer to emotional need lies, of course, in the gospel. It is helpful to read Jonathan Edwards' A Treatise on the Religious Affections. Edwards speaks of affections rather than emotions. Commencing with 1 Peter 1:8, speaks of Jesus Christ, without having seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with unutterable and exalted joy. And he points out that no religion is true that does not have these deep affections. It's as strongly supported in both the Old and New Testaments. Man is an affectional creature. I'm talking about man as man and woman now, and must have emotional fulfillment, or he will see it in improper and perverse ways. If fallen man cannot have love fulfillment, along with peace and joy, he will have it from the idols he devises, the materialism in which he indulges himself, or sexual activity which is outside the true norm of sexuality. So you can see that a man's going to get fulfillment. The entertainment industry, and as somebody pointed out the other day, amusement, that the word literally means against musing, a muse. Do you see that? Is to be against musing, to be against being against thinking, against thoughtfulness, contemplation. It's to stop you having to think about the whole terrible thing. So the entertainment industry is you know, billions of dollars go into it, and I'm amazed, really. It's amazed at the amount of money. Fallen man in his bondage to many enemies. Now, this is sometimes, people don't take this in, we mentioned it in one of our previous studies. If man were left to his own devices, his problems regarding the past and the future, his human condition would be difficult enough. As it is, there are forces in the world which are adverse. He will often find opposition enough within his own family, community, and elsewhere simply on the human level. But the matter does not begin and end there. That's to say, just by nature, those things will be around. But we've seen previously that man who is apart from God faces the evil forces of Satan and his creatures. And the following passages there show that evil powers hold man in bondage through his guilt. They alarm him up, to torment and tease him. On the wider scale, it can be shown that the creatures known as principalities, authorities and powers are brilliant. Don't ever think of the devil as somebody with a hook tail and a fork and all that. Those are medieval depiction. Very brilliant, intellectually brilliant powers, these high angelic forces. Man's fear of death through guilt is one area in which the powers work with pitiless accusation. Man is afraid of death all his life. It is this which further stirs up man's selfishness, his competitive, acquisitive spirit, his self-justifying actions, and keeps him in fear of death and judgment. In the book of the Revelation, the beasts emerge from the nations, epitomizing and expressing their collective beastliness. So those are beasts in the book of the Revelation. You mustn't think of them as literal beasts lumbering around the earth like some, theological dinosaurs, something like that. But you must think of them as actual personal powers that are operative. And so a nation will bring out a beast because of its own innate beastliness. It will give birth to beasts, and that sort of thing. Right. From every side, within and outside himself, fallen man is beset with many terrifying things. Now, we don't have time just for the moment to go into this in depth, but we come back to the saying of Jeremiah, I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself, it is not in man who walks to direct his steps. Man cannot be autonomous by nature of the case. And we sang this morning, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he establishes him in whose way he delights. It can be shown that man's fallenness means he will go his own way, which would not be the way of the Lord. But basically, the verse indicates that man must be in union with God before he can know the will of God and have the moral power to accomplish what God has for him. In the scriptures, the way is the life, walk, and character of a person. But God's way and man's way differ greatly. There has to be a way is evident. You know, in Chinese, the Tao, the word Tao is the way. Is that right, Sikyong? The way. And in Buddhism, you've got the eight steps, and the eightfold steps in the way. And so every culture builds up its way. Man must have a way. He must go somewhere. Indeed, he must arrive somewhere, for that is his destiny. On his own, man cannot devise the authentic way. There are many references in Proverbs, the way of a man. There's a way which seems right unto man, the end whereof are the ways of death, and so on. The man so sure is in the way. So the only hope is what he can accomplish. He must have a hope of some sort, or he's hopeless. So he's got to make up a way, and he's got to make up a goal. Now, I think that's very, very important, the matter of vocation. We'll talk a little bit about it next week, but a little bit this week too, but vocation is very, very important. Not just the vocation you have in order to keep yourself alive, but the whole vocation of life and its goal being the glorious inheritance of the children of God. So according to the scripture alone, God alone plans what is man's goal, and so sets man's hope from the cradle to the grave. He is in the vocation God has given him. When he refuses this vocation to devise his own, then he can have no assurance that it is the valid vocation. This is another cause of anxiety and distress. Both the way and the goal are uncertain. This uneasiness is linked with anger. To be without hope and without God in the world is a hopeless and empty life condition. So when we meet people, we're going to have to ascertain where they are in the matter of vocation.